So that brings up another topic that I know you've written about. I was recently reading a white paper, a position paper that you had written that's at the Center for American Progress website, which is to do with Social Security. And where do I begin? So there's such a lot here. So one thing I wanted to do was to backtrack just a little bit, which is you started off this evening telling us about that 5 years ago, the American economy was running about a 2% of GDP surplus, and now we're at about a 4% deficit. But that surplus was in part, as far as I understand the accounting, was in part due to a planned over-collection, if you will, of Social Security taxes to cover future obligations. Is that right?
That is correct. Let's see whether... where we best start here.
Okay.
I thought
might be useful to do is to paint the big picture involving the Greenspan Commission and Alan Greenspan's role in actually promoting the tax cuts which arose from the surplus, which have led us into the absurd situation we're in today.
I think that's a good start. What people have to understand, in 1983, Social Security needed more money. It basically, the trust funds had been exhausted in 1982. And a commission chaired by Alan Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan made a number of bipartisan recommendations, many of which were enacted in 1983 and signed into law by President Reagan. The part of that was that beginning in 1983, Social Security would take in more taxes than it needed to pay benefits. So it would have a surplus. It would use that surplus to buy Treasury bonds, basically put them, that's the trust fund, would put them in a trust fund. And then in the future, there would be a time with the baby boomers retiring where Social Security would have less tax money coming in than it needed to pay benefits, and then would basically sell the Treasury bonds back to the Treasury and use that money to pay the benefits. Under current projections from the Social Security Administration, that scheme with a trust fund would be enough for Social Security to pay full benefits till 2041. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that actually would be enough to pay full benefits till 2052.
Right.
So for the next 36 or 47 years, we will be fine for Social Security, so we can pay full benefits. And to just be very clear, nobody, no conservative, no progressive, doubts that this is what will happen, that the government will honor the promise that it will actually buy back the treasuries through treasury bonds from Social Security, will give the money to Social
Wait,
Security.
Wait, those are worthless pieces of paper in a filing cabinet.
I dispute that.
I'm a conservative.
These are worthless IOUs, I'm told. So,
well, let me, rather than go through like the complex economic theories of why worthless IOUs are also the money in your wallet. let me explain the very common sense argument.
Okay, great.
Imagine, basically, in under current expectations, in 2017, Social Security will have to start selling some of its IOUs. You can call them whatever you want: Treasury bonds, IOUs, funny money.
But to be clear, the Social Security Administration has been loaning the U.S. government money, along with, as you mentioned earlier, foreign governments like, for example, the Bank of Japan and so forth, have been loaning the United States money in exchange for promissory notes.
That's correct.
Okay,
and,
good.
And so, like in 2018, Social Security would basically go to the Treasury and say, like, I want my money back. Please give me my money. I need to have that money to pay benefits. Now, if you really think that this is funny money and worthless IOUs, you would have to also believe that the Treasury would have to tell the Social Security Administration to go home, that it wouldn't honor that promise. That's the logical conclusion from that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however, in 2018, the Chinese government would also come to the Treasury and say, like, I lent you all this money. Please pay me my money. I need that to pay infrastructure measures in China. Now, that one is not treated as a worthless IOU. Everybody thinks that that's real. It's a treasury bond that is held by the Chinese government. So people who talk about the trust fund as a worthless IOU are basically saying, well, the government in 2018 will tell the elderly Americans that it will not honor its promises, but it will tell the Chinese government it will tell its promises to the Chinese government. I don't think there's a single American politician who would be reelected if that really happened. that if we defaulted to our promises to the elderly, but paid our promises to the Japanese or Chinese government. So I think just common sense dictates we will make our promise payment to the Chinese, to the Japanese, to the British, and the German governments, but we also will make our promises to the American retirees.
Well, I certainly should hope so, because after all, given the $90,000 cutoff on the Social Security tax, we can say quite clearly that all of this money that's been loaned to the U.S. government was loaned to it by the average worker. And if for the U.S. government to question the validity of that debt, I think is absolutely outrageous.
Well, and it's also, I mean, like, this is not something new. I mean, it was designed by Alan Greenspan. I mean, it was designed by a bipartisan commission, chaired by Alan Greenspan, signed into law by Ronald Reagan, and it was a generational promise. It was like, yes,
right.
The workers in the 1980s and 1990s overpaid to give Social Security, the federal government money, but with the understanding that that money would be there when they retired.
To sustain.
It was a baby boomer's piggy bank.
Right.
And, I think saying it's a worthless IOU says, like, I'm going to smash the baby boomer's piggy bank.
So now we fast forward about 18 years to 2001, and the U.S. economy is running has an operating surplus, and Alan Greenspan testifies before Congress as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. I wonder if you could pick up the story from there.
Yeah, Alan Greenspan testified in 2001 and basically said, like, at that point, the government had so much surplus that we should give massive tax cuts because we would be paying down the national debt too fast, and we then wouldn't know what to do with all the money, regardless of the fact that there's many schools that are in desperate need of repair and that we need to fix our port security.
And we are talking about the same Alan Greenspan.
It is the same Alan Greenspan. This is not...
no mistaken identity here.
And the interesting... So that gave President Bush a lot of cover to push through the tax cuts in 2001. The interesting thing is that since we have a deficit, Alan Greenspan has not come back to Congress and said, like, well, I was wrong, please take back the tax cuts, because now we actually need the money to pay down the debt. And members of Congress have actually pressed him on that. It's unclear the politics of the Fed chairman on this, I think generally, I think he's veered into a more political direction than more economic direction.
There's an image of the Fed chairman being a nonpartisan, scholarly, objective analyst, and that's been really shattered by these last few years. And Krugman has pointed that out really vividly in his columns, calling Greenspan a political hack and things like that.
I think it's inconsistent with his position. I mean, I can see somewhat the economic argument for tax cuts, although, as I said, like, I think that we should have had a national debate over whether the best way to spend the money is for tax cuts, or whether actually addressing the nation's needs would have been a better way to spend the money in 2001. But it's inconsistent to advocate the tax cuts in 2001 and not advocate for taking them back in 2003 and 2004 and 2005. When we had massive deficits.
Given the reality of the situation.
Correct.
Indeed. And so now we have the situation now where the Bush administration is, well, questioning the validity of the Social Security administration's debt and is creating a scare that the system will be flat broke. That's a quote, will be flat broke, bankrupt, as the president said. I want you to imagine the Social Security administration being bankrupt, being flat broke in 2052 or 2048 or different time frames. And of course, this is a complete and total falsehood. And so what we really have here is what really is the problem, if there is a problem at all, with the Social Security insurance system that we currently have in place?
As I said, there's two estimates over Social Security's future, so I'll talk about both of them. One comes from the Social Security Administration, the other one from the Congressional Budget Office. Under either scenario, Social Security can pay benefits, full benefits, promised benefits, without any tax increases for the next 35, 45 years. After that date, Social Security would still get money. It wouldn't stop getting taxes just because the trust fund has run out. The taxes under the Social Security estimates would be enough to pay 74% of all promised benefits in 2042. Under the Congressional Budget Office's estimates, it would be enough to pay 82% of all promised benefits. So Social Security can still pay the vast majority of its benefits. To also put this in perspective, those benefits would be higher than the benefits people would get today, even in inflation-adjusted terms. So Social Security can pay future benefits. Now, clearly that's a shortfall relative to what's been promised, and the question is, how do we address that shortfall?
Right.
Is that manageable? Yes, it's absolutely manageable. According to the Social Security Administration's estimates, it's the cost of fixing that is 0.6% of gross domestic product. To put this in perspective, we're spending over 1% of our gross domestic product just on the war in Iraq. So clearly, Social Security is manageable. Under the Congressional Budget Office's estimates, 0.4% of gross domestic product. Again, it's a vastly smaller amount than what we spend on other things such as defense or a war in Iraq. So, I mean, it's manageable. The other part, and then that's really, I think, when what's also often mentioned in the scare tactics is like, well, you know, the costs are exploding, this is getting out of control. There's an interesting number in the Social Security Trustees report, and it's called the cost of Social Security relative to gross domestic product over the next 75 years, and it's one of those tables projections. When you look at that, the cost of Social Security relative to gross domestic product in 2030 is 6.5%. In 2080, it's 6.5%. So the costs will actually remain the same once the baby boomers are all gone. So there's no reason to panic here. We can handle that. It's a manageable problem, and it's not an unsustainable problem. It doesn't get out of control. It's certainly something we can address.
Well, the arguments they present are things like, well, the number of workers who are having to support the number of retirees, is that ratio has changed dramatically. There's many fewer workers now than there used to be compared to the number of retirees. But that statistic, it's irrelevant. If you actually look at the numbers, it doesn't matter based on, you know, what's actually going to happen.
Yeah, when it comes to the number of retirees to workers, I'm happy that I'm married to a family of math-inclined people. One of them is a CMU alum. Mm-hmm. The point is, people should really go back and do their basic math here. When the president said, we've gone from 16 workers to one retiree to now 3 workers to one retiree, and in the future we'll go from 3 to 1 to 2 to 1, and that will be a problem. Now, you got to say, like, well, why wasn't it a problem going from 16 to 1 to 3 to 1, but going from 3 to 1 to 2 to 1 will be a problem? And then really, it's just like, I'm astounded how he can get away with this basic math issue.
Yeah. Let me just mention the phone number again. We're talking to Christian Weller, an economist, and you can give us a call at 412-268-9728.
This might be a good moment to mention that the Center for American Progress website is www.americanprogress.org, and they have lots of interesting articles there on many different issues of interest to listeners of Left Out, including many articles on economics. That's why we're talking with Dr. Weller here today. So this brings up another point that you've commented on in one of your white papers, which is to do with this whole idea of privatization. So I think we can safely say whatever this privatization issue is about, it is not about solving the crisis of Social Security. So it's really about dismantling Social Security myself, that there's an ideological opposition to having a national insurance system. But let's try to look at it purely from an economic perspective. So I wonder if you might want to comment on the privatization scheme that is being promoted.
Okay. Before I go into the details and explain that, let me be very clear that people hear this. The president has not put forward a complete plan. There are some aspects of the plan of what he may or may not support. There is a lot of tea leaf reading about what the president stands for. And when I talk about the specifics, and when most people talk about the specifics, we actually go back to the President Bush's commission from 2001. So just to be very clear on this,
because that's the only solid information we actually have to go on.
That's the only complete plan that we actually have that we can attribute to those who want to privatize.
So that's fair enough. Good.
Under Social Security privatization, what it would mean is you would have the option to put money into an individual account, money that is currently going to Social Security, currently going to paying benefits, would go into a private account, and the money would then be no longer available to pay for benefits. And what Social Security then would have to do is turn around and borrow more money because it has to pay money now. People who are retired, to disabled workers and their families, to the widows and widowers, the orphans of diseased workers who have accumulated benefits under Social Security. So Social Security would have to borrow more money. For the next 20 years, it would have to borrow $4.9 trillion to basically fill in that hole from the money being diverted into private accounts.
So it exacerbates the problem. Whatever problems.
That's correct. The establishment of private accounts does absolutely nothing for Social Security's solvency. The president has not claimed otherwise. Vice President Cheney has not claimed otherwise. And neither have any of the academics who support this idea have claimed otherwise. It does not improve the solvency. It actually makes it worse. The establishment of private accounts, the privatization part, does not. It actually worsens the solvency for Social Security over the next 75 years. So we have to be very clear that that's part of the proposal. The other part is, because as you just mentioned, there is a solvency issue that we have to address. Over the long run, over the next 75 years, we need to get some money to Social Security. And the way the president proposes, or the Commission to Strengthen Social Security proposed to address that problem, is to cut benefits. You just cut benefits year after year after year after year after year. So by the time I would retire, benefits would be about 30% less. By the time people who are being born now would retire, would be about 50% less than what Social Security would pay.
But
that
also
benefit cut would happen for everybody, regardless of whether you put your money into an individual account or not. Now, let's talk about the people who decide to put their money into an individual account.
Good.
Not only would they get the benefit cut that everybody would get, they also have this individual account that they have established by basically getting a loan from Social Security. They have taken money away from Social Security. By the time they retire, Social Security wants that money back. And it will want it back with interest. And the president has said how much interest the government would actually, or the Social Security would actually charge to people who have these accounts. It would be 3% above inflation. So the only way you can actually have some money in your account and come out ahead is if you generate a rate of return above 3%, above 3% above inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that easy to do. With a mixed portfolio, given the market fluctuations and so on and so forth, that's about market average. So by and large, on average, you can expect to have a flat zero in your account by the time you retire under the scheme.
There'd be variance. But even if you manage to have something in that account, it's not an annuity like the Social Security payments. It's a finite amount of money, and that if you live a long time, you're going to go through all of that money, right?
That is correct. There are some wrinkles now. The president has not laid out a complete plan for privatization, but he has detailed some of the private account parts. So by the time you retire and you have paid back that loan to Social Security and you have that severely cut benefit from Social Security, the government then looks at all of that and says, okay, well, let's look at how much money you have in that account. If your guaranteed benefit from Social Security does not give you a benefit that is at least a poverty line, you then have to go out with whatever money you have in your individual account and go to an insurance company and buy an annuity, meaning a lifetime benefit. The government basically makes it very clear you don't have a choice over this. Like, you have to buy an annuity so at least you will have a benefit that pays you poverty. The only way you can actually have some money left over for your children under this scheme is if you're willing to live at the poverty line for the rest of your life, you will have some money left over.
Yeah, this is crucial because part of the Bamboozle Palooza tour line is that they are that this money would somehow be available for your children to inherit. But in fact, the way annuities work is they're banking on the fact that you're not going to have that money to give to your children. In fact, they're going to banking on the fact that you're not going to be able to use it at all, use all of it that's there.
Right. I mean, the insurance company is taking the risk, or, as you said,
right,
banking on the fact that you die earlier than expected.
Right.
That's how they make the money on the annuity.
That's how it
but
works.
But they give you an exchange, they give you the guarantee that you won't run out of money before you die. And the only way you can really have any money under the president's scheme left over is if you're willing to live at the poverty line and you had enough money to begin with to give you a benefit that's above the poverty line, which both are two big ifs.
And from a it's just a large scale kind of macroeconomic perspective, I think is if you're going to have you can help me out here, you're going to have lots and lots of millions of Americans suddenly investing in the stock market, let us say, and if you or bond market, other securities, but let's just say stock market, and you in order for that all of those people to make money, you have to somehow think that the market is vastly undervalued, which I don't think there's any evidence for at the moment, and that it will remain undervalued even in the presence of such a massive influx of money. I mean, how is this possible?
Well, I mean, that's why many people think that the privatization scheme is a prescription to create one of the biggest stock market bubbles in the world. Not only do you have to expect that the market is undervalued, you also have to expect there will be somebody at the end of your life, at your working life, who is willing to buy the stocks from you. At
right,
the price
and continue
that you
to believe.
And I mean, the whole premise that we start from is we need to get more money to the baby boomers. Now, meaning there are these baby boomers, there's more of them than of their children. They didn't have that many children. So the baby boomers are now investing in the stock market. They're buying all the stock. They're driving up stock prices. And then basically 20, 30 years from now, they're turning to the children that they didn't have and want to sell it to them. I mean, the question is, who is going to buy the stocks when the baby boomers need to sell? And quite frankly, if you look around the world, it's ultimately the answer is, well, people in India and China may buy it, but I don't think they will have enough money to do that.
Is there a prospect that, well, one possibility would be the economy grows so quickly that there would be plenty of investment vehicles and ways to use that money and invest that money. What are the prospects, you think, for that?
Well, I mean, you can investment is only as good as the profits it will generate. And
right.
The profits depend on people and the economy growing, on people buying stuff, and it doesn't work that way. I mean, like, if the economy is relative to the size of people selling stocks smaller than expected, stock prices will fall just simply because profit opportunities are not there. You cannot invest endlessly. People will ultimately have to buy them, the stuff you're producing with that investment, in order to keep the economy alive. I mean, ultimately, this is, and people have pointed this out, there's a number of serious research studies who've pointed out that you get a demographic bulge in the stock market, which will drive up prices now, but would ultimately will lead to a bubble crash by the time the baby boomers retire.
So when looked at from the perspective we've been looking at it, which I like to think of as a sober, fact-based perspective, the whole, either side of the story, the story of Social Security being in crisis or the story of the magical, wonderful effects of privatization of Social Security, neither one of them even begins to hold water. I don't see any story that makes any sense whatsoever. So the question is, what's really going on here? What is this all about? Do you have ideas about this?
It's hard to say. Let me be very clear. I mean, the way Social Security privatization is talked about, there are two issues here. One is solvency for Social Security, improving
right.
solvency for Social Security. The other one is creating wealth for America's middle class. And we already discussed the solvency issue. Privatization would actually make solvency worse for the next 75 years, and conservatives have admitted that. In terms of wealth, it would actually destroy wealth by cutting Social Security benefits, so
right.
it wouldn't do that either. So it doesn't achieve the proclaimed goal, so the other question is, what will it do? What it will do to some degree is it will end the insurance value of Social Security.
Right
now, Social Security redistributes money within the system to those who need it the most, the widows and orphans, the families
handicapped.
Of disabled workers.
Yeah.
So it distributes money where it's most needed. That part doesn't happen with an individual account. That money, you pay it in, you get it out. There's no redistribution within Social Security, within individual account system. So the insurance value of Social Security goes away, and it goes from a family-based benefit for one where we help each other out to a me benefit. And I don't think that that's really what American family values are about. I don't think that's what Americans want.
Yeah. Let me just I suggest that we should keep on talking until the end of the hour with Christian Weller. There's still time for you to give us a call. We know there are listeners out there. We're not scary. We're you can ask any question you want. We'll respond to it. The number is 412-268-9728.
So another topic I wanted to take up with you was you touched on earlier in talking about the state of the economy, which I think are the related issues. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me are related issues of the softness in the dollar in the international markets, particularly against the euro, and the related problems of outsourcing and trade deficits. And I wonder if you could expand a bit on that.
Okay, let me see whether I can do this quickly.
Okay.
Right now, we borrow tons of money to pay, particularly to finance the budget deficit in the U.S. That has helped to keep the dollar high for some time. But when you look at the numbers, the foreigners, in particular the Japanese, are somewhat more reluctant to lend us money. So their money is not coming as freely into the U.S., and that has led to a decline of the dollar. While that is certainly welcome, while we certainly want the dollar to go down a little bit just because it has been highly valued for the last few years and has caused a big trade deficit, the problem is that if the Japanese or the Koreans or the Chinese or the Germans or British stop buying dollars at the rate that they have, the dollar could plunge very quickly. And that can be very disruptive to the economy. I mean, basically, Alan Greenspan would have to step in and raise interest rates to slow the fall of the dollar, and then that would slow growth and so on and so forth. So I think that's our biggest problem. It's also, in terms of the overall problem of the trade deficit, much bigger than, for instance, the outsourcing issue. Clearly, they're linked, because it does make for an export, if you're an exporting company and you face... Basically, because of the high value of the dollar, you face a 25-30% tax on your exports because the value of the dollar is so high.
Mm-hmm.
It does make sense to think about relocating your production to another country. And so there is some evidence that companies have done that. But hopefully, if the dollar declines, comes down to a more sustainable level, the trade deficit shrinks, companies have less of an incentive to actually leave the U.S. and actually stay with their production here.
Now, this threat of the foreign governments, refusing to continue financing our deficits, I think is not completely hypothetical. Wasn't there recently a comment, and I was trying to remember, by either the Japanese or the Chinese government, to the effect that the U.S. ought to start carrying its own freight?
Well, all the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Koreans all have made comments. I think the most interesting one is the Koreans, because they're actually the smallest lenders out of the three. And when the Koreans said, like, we may be looking to put our money somewhere else, the dollar all of a sudden plunged by like 3 or 4%.
That's what I was thinking of as Koreans.
Really, if the Korean government, with a minor, mild announcement like that, can send shockwaves through the currency markets, something is really off, and people should give note to that.
So I think another issue which is related to this is I've heard talk, and I don't know how serious it is, of redenominating various kind of international transactions in euros. I wondered if you could explain what that means for the U.S. and the U.S. economy.
It's the same. It's basically the same issue. If there are fewer transactions in dollars and more in euro, people need to buy fewer dollars. They need to bring less money here to get dollars, less of their money here to get dollars. And it will make it harder for us to finance, in particular, our budget deficits right now with foreign money. And that's just the law of supply and demand. We get less money, so the supply of foreign demand goes down. We still need that money. We still demand the same amount. And if demand stays the same, supply goes down, the price goes up, and that means interest rates will rise.
So in other words, if the fact that the world economy is kind of has been traditionally based on the dollar, that fact allowed us to get more countries to invest dollars back in the U.S.
That's exactly it. I mean,
and if that changes,
because the dollar has been the favorite in many, many markets. I mean, you go to many countries and you can actually pay with a dollar, like Argentina or Brazil or others. And that is changing gradually because the euro is there, but also because people are nervous about what's happening to the dollar. It's losing value. And nobody knows where it's going. And that makes it harder for us, and that will ultimately lead to higher interest rates, in particular higher interest rates for mortgages, which is a big ticket item for households here. And then
right.
Let me just make the last point on mortgages.
Okay.
More and more households have taken out not fixed-rate mortgages, not 30-year mortgages, but adjustable-rate mortgages.
Oh, boy.
So if interest rates go up, that will
could be trouble.
Higher costs almost immediately.
All right, lead us back to bankruptcy.
Back to bankruptcy. Okay, well, that brings us back to where we started. Well, that brings us to the end of the hour on Left Out. Dr. Weller, thank you very much for appearing on Left Out. It's been a great pleasure having you on the program today. This is Dr. Christian Weller, who's a senior economist for the Center for American Progress. The website I mentioned earlier, www.americanprogress.org, is available. Also, information on the Left Out website at leftout.info. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.